I'd like now to welcome Dawn Wink. She's a writer and teacher, and she will be giving a public talk on linguistics, human rights. Welcome, Dawn, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Linguistic human rights. Let's just talk about that term. What does that mean?
Basically, what linguistic human rights are every person's inherent right to speak their mother tongue, to speak their native language in whatever context that is. If people want to speak their native language out in public, if in schools, it's the inherent human right that people have to speak their native language.
Now, that is a construct that probably came up in the context of disappearing languages and the forced learning of new languages by whoever is colonizing or dominating a people.
Right.
How did you get into this whole field of study? Through what languages?
Well, I speak Spanish and German, and my undergraduate degree was in international relations, and I was always very interested in human rights. And later I went on and got into bilingual ed, and so those two passions kind of dovetailed into linguistic human rights.
And so what were some of the first actual cases that you observed of people trying to exercise their linguistic human rights?
Well, my first teaching position was as a bilingual teacher in a small rural town in California. And I started the first bilingual education program that the town had ever seen. And this was an area, all of the kids were the kids of migrant school work or migrant laborers. And they had been historically marginalized. I mean, they were still kids who, they were not allowed to speak Spanish on the playground. And I saw this, what the ramifications were, both socially and educationally. And it really, you know, to me, this whole idea of speaking on your mother tongue, it isn't a theory. It's letting Carlos speak to his mom in Spanish when he's on the playground. And so it really came home to me that this was not something abstract, that this is, you know, direct consequences. Our language is really our heart, our spirit, our history, our family. And so when people aren't allowed to express themselves, it affects all of that.
Now, what are bilingual education programs? Let's talk about the one that you set up. I think there's a lot of talk about that, then people not understanding what these programs are.
Right.
There's also a fear that if they're bilingual education programs, then people from other countries aren't going to learn English properly.
Right. Sure. And it's that's a great question, because it's very important to understand. When people say bilingual ed, there's a lot of different things that people mean. And what we know historically, what we know from research, is that the primary indicator for learning a second language, so the primary indicator for when people come to the United States learning English, is to be literate and fluent in their primary language. And so what the whole point of bilingual education programs, when they're properly done, and there are a lot out there that are not properly done, but the whole point is success in English, in addition to maintaining those ties with heritage and with their family. But it's not just that. We know that the best way for people to learn English is if they're literate in their primary language first, and then all of that translates over to English.
Now, when you have a bilingual education program in this country, it's primarily Spanish.
Right. There are lots of different languages. I mean, there's Chinese in San Francisco in the Bay Area. There's Korean. But most people do think of Spanish.
So it's you've made actually quite an interesting statement that success in English depends on their ability to speak and write their own languages fluently?
Exactly. Exactly. Which is why it seems kind of counterintuitive. We see kids who are born in the United States but come from homes where they speak other languages, they start kindergarten. And in general, those kids don't do as well academically as immigrant kids or immigrants who come to the United States who are already literate in their primary language. And we know that's the indicator for success. It's like when I went and
Why
lived
is
in,
that?
Well, because you only learn how to read and write once. And then that translates to whatever language you're learning. So when I went to live in Mexico, all I had to do was learn the vocabulary, but I already knew how to read. And if you never, for the kids who are born here A lot of times they're being taught how to read in a language they don't understand. And so what they need to do is be taught to read it in whatever their native language is, and it directly transfers over to English.
Now, my father, for example, his first mm-hmm. language was Sicilian. Mm-hmm. He didn't know a word of English until he hit school at age 6.
Right.
There was no bilingual education. He learned to read and write in English.
Right.
Learned only later to read and write in his native
mm-hmm.
language.
Mm-hmm.
And he got a PhD.
Yeah.
What's wrong with that model?
Well, there are people who that was possible, that they did do that. The vast majority of, like, when, because you hear my grandparents made it without bilingual ed, or what's wrong, why can't these people? The vast majority of people in that generation didn't go on to college and didn't go on to get a PhD. And so there were all of these wonderful economic opportunities that were open to people. They didn't have to be literate in English. They could speak in English, but it didn't prohibit them from doing well economically in the United States. Whereas now, with computers, with this dense literacy that you have to have in order to succeed, it's an entirely different world. You know?
But children are so absorbent at the age of 5, 6, mm-hmm, 7, 8, 9.
Mm-hmm,
they pick up languages so quickly, so easily. Why not pick up the foreign? Why wouldn't they? And they do pick up foreign languages.
What we run into problems is they pick up what we call social language. They pick up playground language. They sound very fluent in English, but there's this whole level which we call academic language underneath, and that's like the foundation for being able to read a textbook and understanding it, being able to take these abstract ideas and make meaning. And they're not necessarily able to do that in English. They can do all this social stuff. They sound very fluent, but it's they don't have the academic grounding and understanding that they need in order to succeed.
Now, in Santa Fe, one wonders if the native English speakers have that in our school system.
Well, I mean, I think, and then there's the whole social, I mean, native English speakers, it's the dominant language. I mean, they have all that sociocultural, dominance that comes with speaking the primary language.
But the point is, I mean, let's say native Spanish-speaking kids mm-hmm. are not getting the academic grounding, maybe it's the school system who isn't teaching it to anybody properly. I mean, there's a lot of kids who get to the ninth grade who don't even know what grammar is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. My kids are in the public school system here in Santa Fe, and I've been pleased with what their experiences have been as a whole. And so I think, I think that's really an individual thing. I think that comes down to individual kids, individual families. I know what you're saying.
Let's talk about, I mean, you wrote an interesting essay about your experience with Lakota language and Lakota
mm-hmm.
people.
Right.
Part of the, I mean, Spanish isn't going anywhere. Whether or not we have native bilingual education programs in the United States, mm-hmm. Spanish is spoken in many countries.
Mm-hmm.
But indigenous languages are really in danger, and that's
yes.
part of what you look at.
Right, yeah. Well, right now, indigenous languages are dying off faster than at any point in history. And at the rate that we're losing indigenous languages right now, within the next 100 years, 90% of indigenous languages will be gone. And so a lot of my work and what many people involved in linguistic human rights, it's trying to save these indigenous languages and not let them die.
And the reason for that is, I mean, when you read about the rate at which languages are dying, for mm-hmm. all the world, it sounds like the rate of species going extinct.
Right. There's actually a correlation. It's interesting. This one writer who's very involved in linguistic human rights, Tove Skutnam Kangas, she has done a study where she has looked at the species, the variety of species of butterflies and birds in a specific area, and she's made those correlations as far as how many, the diversity of languages and the diversity of
Species,
primarily butterflies and birds. And as one goes down, and she looked at the birds and the butterflies, there is almost a direct correlation with loss of variety of language. And so it is. They are going extinct in a very similar manner.
So how does that work? I mean, so you have people who are colonized. Colonizers tend to kill butterflies?
Well, a lot of what she has found is that as we lose forests, as we lose natural environments, that the species and the languages are absorbed in the dominant culture. And so in the United States it would be English. In the United States it would be these languages are all being absorbed by the dominant culture in English. She does a lot of research in like Southeast Asia and places where, there are hundreds of languages being spoken.
We're talking to Dawn Wink, and she's going to be giving a talk on linguistic human rights and endangered languages at 7 o'clock tomorrow night at 1315 Luana Street for Penn, New Mexico's Writers Roundtable. What does the term heritage languages mean?
Heritage language is the language of your family of origin. So, for example, your father's heritage language would have been
Sicilian.
And so that's all it is. It's just it's basically your mother tongue.
And so the idea of preserving heritage languages for children so that they know their roots better is part of what this whole conversation's about.
It is. It is, but it's... it's so much more also, because not only to know their roots, but for example, to be able to speak in a language that best captures the heart and soul with one's parents or with one's grandparents. For example, I speak Spanish fluently, but I speak when I'm talking to my kids, when I'm cuddling with my kids, I speak in English, because there's a connection there, there's an intimacy there that comes with one's native language. And so when that is lost, it's not just the language or the history, it's those familial connections, it's that intimacy and closeness.
So tell us more about your work. Let's get back to the Lakota example. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because in the essay that you wrote that I was reading last night, it talked about some Lakota people at a conference on languages that you went to said, gee, here come the white people telling us what to do again. We know perfectly well that our language is necessary to preserve, and now you're telling us how to do it. Screw
right.
you.
Right. Yeah. And that's one thing that I think it goes along with I'm Anglo, and I'm in this field of bilingual ed and indigenous languages, and people are justifiably circumspect because there's such a long history of people who look like me coming in and saying, this is what you need to do with your language. And for years and years it was, do not speak this language to your kids, or speak English, don't promote this. I mean, historically they were corporally punished. And so there's of course a natural suspicion. And I know that, and I think that they have every right to feel that way. What I found is once we start talking, we realize we're philosophically in the same place.
Yeah, it was so interesting, because this one of the people who was speaking about this was very angry about, I mean, you feel even just in reading your essay that there were 500 years of anger in all of his words about linguistics. And then at the end you sort of went up to him and said, well, I'm a white girl, this is my passion, what do you think I should do? And he said, keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, and I think that's what my experience has been. Once we start talking, that's where it comes to. I think, we all do what we can. And if we all contribute in the ways that we feel passionate about, that's all we can do. And I'm not going to not speak out just because I am Anglo.
Now, let's talk about Lakota in general. To what extent has Lakota language been lost? To what extent is it making a comeback?
Well, it's definitely a moribund language. And what that means is it is dying. And it is making a comeback. But presently there are more native speakers who are dying than there are people learning it. And so, but there are wonderful, passionate people who are very involved in setting up Lakota programs, in speaking Lakota. Now, you know, the kids are learning Lakota. And so, but it's still a very much an uphill battle. I mean, unless at the rate things are going, it'll still die off unless more people get involved and more kids learn Lakota. And there's very, you know, wonderful, passionate people who are looking to trying to get a Lakota immersion program going in the Black Hills and go, you know, but right now it's not there yet.
What is the realistic possibility of having people grow up and bilingually and then mm-hmm. pass that on to their children and have generations of bilingualism one after another?
Well, they do it all around the world. I mean, most places in the world, people are bilingual, trilingual. It's not thought of as anything unusual. But in the United States, we have a history of, I mean, we really kill languages faster than most other places on the planet. And people from other parts of the world look to us and wonder why we aren't bilingual, because it's the norm in most places. And, you know, you can't talk about this without talking about power, without talking about the power structure that goes with languages, and why the United States has so intentionally tried to kill off other languages and make the United States an English only.
And why do you think they have?
Well, I think language is power. And historically, indigenous languages, people knew that the primary way to colonize somebody was to cut off that ability to speak, that ability to think in their own language, that ability, and it scared them, because if somebody was speaking Lakota and I had no idea what they were saying, it was very, it was very intimidating to people. And so that was one of the first things they did, was to try to cut off that language.
English has become the lingua franca, so to speak, mm-hmm. around the world. It's the common language. Is that a good thing? Is it good to have a common language?
That, there's a whole other, there are many thinkers and writers who directly tie that to, they call it linguicism and linguistic imperialism, and they directly tie that to the loss of so much of the richness of these variety of languages. I think it'd be great if there were a lot more people who were bilingual. I think there's nothing wrong with having a common language. But we're pretty arrogant in the United States. We expect everybody around the world to learn English, and we don't need to learn these other languages. And not only with a language goes a whole world view and a whole perspective. And to have to not experience the world through these other languages and cultures creates a narrowness that I think we see in this country, that when one speaks another language, when one lives in another culture or sees the world through those views, you see the world through a variety of perspectives, and I think that's a good thing.
Well, we must, on that note, take off right now. I want to thank you so much for being with us. Dawn Wink is a writer and teacher, and she's giving a talk on linguistic human rights and endangered languages at 7 o'clock tomorrow, March 6th, at 1315 Luana Street, which is right off of Cerrillos Road, kind of across the street from the Smith Supermarket area, more or less. You can call 988-5185. For directions and more information, and this is part of the Penn New Mexico Writers Roundtable. I just have to say in closing, 6,000 to 7,000 languages on the planet Earth.
Right.
It really gives one a sense of humility, because nobody can learn them all.
Right. Mm-hmm. And think about, I mean, in each of those languages, the richness of culture and way of looking at the world and way of understanding the world. And to lose that would create so much of a flatter plane of existence, in my opinion, whereas all those languages give depth and richness and multiple perspectives and understandings. And to lose that, we lose so much beauty and knowledge.
Don Wink, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.